Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm an Assistant Director of Networks with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host a Courthouse Steps preview webinar on Olivier v. City of Brandon, featuring Nate Kellum. Nate is Senior Counsel for First Liberty Institute. Prior to coming to First Liberty, Nate was the founder and chief counsel of the Center for Religious Expression. For over three decades, Nate has defended religious liberty in courtrooms across the country. He has handled more than 500 litigated cases and 50 appeals before various federal appellate courts, winning numerous landmark decisions. Our moderator today is Tobias Loss Eaton. Tobias is partner at Sidley Austin LLP, where he's an appellate and regulatory litigator, helping clients navigate complex, novel, or high-stakes legal issues. Tobias has written or co-authored over 185 briefs in state and federal appellate courts, including over 90 briefs in the Supreme Court. He has presented oral argument in the 2nd, 4th, 6th, 7th, and D.C. circuits, and in state appellate and Supreme Courts, producing successful results for his clients in 70% of the appeals he argued. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, thank you both for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Marco. And thank you also for reading the advertising boilerplate from my attorney bio. Your check is in the mail for that. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm excited to be here with you and with Nate. I think this is a fascinating case. And one that actually I've been interested in quite a while. Nate and I first connected about this case probably two full years ago at this point. I was wearing my hat as the co-director of the Northwestern Supreme Court Clinic. And as soon as the panel decision in this case came down, we identified it as a candidate for Supreme Court review. I got in touch with Nate. We didn't end up working together directly on it, but I was pleased to be able to write amicus briefs supporting Nate's position, both at the cert stage and then the merit stage in this case. So I'm really looking forward to talking to you, Nate, about this case and the winding road that it took you to get here.
Yeah, it has been a windy road, but I'm excited to be at this point. And I remember well our first conversation.
Well, and so before we dive in, I'll just say, of course, everybody should please feel free to ask questions as you go. I've got the Q&A panel open here, and you'll just have to bear with me as I figure out how to work it. But if you do have anything that you want to ask as we're going along, just toss it in there and we'll work it in. So, Nate, can you just start by telling us about the facts of this case? How did it arise?
Sure. Gentleman who I've gotten to know pretty well now, Gabe Olivier, he lives in Brandon, Mississippi, and there's a local park. And what Gabe likes to do is he likes to share his faith, his Christian faith. And he goes to public places. And this park is particularly well suited for this purpose, because a lot of people attend the park, especially when there are concerts and events going on in a nearby amphitheater. So he ran into problems on May 1, 2021, when he goes out there for this purpose. But Brandon had passed a new ordinance, and this ordinance would require him to move some 300 feet away from pedestrian foot traffic. And that would be the folks walking in and out of the amphitheater. And so he checked it out, but he's quickly surmised that it was just completely unworkable for what he wanted to do, because it separated his message from his intended audience. And that seemed to be the whole idea behind the law in the first place. And so he goes back to a place where he could actually reach people, but he was promptly arrested. And then he pled no contest, and he paid a fine. But the thing is, he wanted to go back. He wanted to go back and be able to share his faith. And he felt certain that he could be able to challenge this law in court. And so we talked about that, and I agreed. This law seemed patently unconstitutional. And so we filed a lawsuit attempting to enjoin this law from being applied against him in the future.
And how did you first get connected with Mr. Olivier?
He gave me a call. I'm not sure how he knew about me, but we at the time, and what I do now is work for a nonprofit, Christian nonprofit, then with Center for Religious Expression, and now we're with First Liberty Institute. And we provide services free of charge for individuals who believe that their constitutional rights have been violated, particularly as it would regard religious liberty. And certainly that's what Mr. Olivier believed, and that's how we ended up helping him.
Got it. Well, and I think it's maybe not sort of strictly relevant to the legal merits, but it sounds like this ordinance was passed maybe in response to Mr. Olivier's activities. Does it seem like it was aimed at him and maybe the group that he was preaching with?
It certainly seems that way. It is very conspicuous in the sense that it seemed to be geared toward his type of speech, although they labeled it as protests and demonstrations in the ordinance itself. But that did happen to link to what police officers and how they referenced his speech in the past is as a protest. That's not what he's there to do. He's there to evangelize. Nevertheless, that label stuck in the ordinance, and that's how they interpreted as far as applying it to him, really seemed to be geared to doing something about his speech, because I believe they thought it was unseemly to be in the park.
Got it. Well, so then what happened in the district court and in the Fifth Circuit once you brought that suit?
Well, that's when I started to learn about this Heck v. Humphrey case. I wasn't really familiar with it before, but have certainly become familiar with it since. The court dismissed the case without even considering the merits of it based on this Heck doctrine that came from the 1994 case of Heck v. Humphrey, a case that really dealt with a prisoner. And what the court was deciding there is whether a prisoner could make a claim that really related to a criminal process, that the plaintiff there had concerns about how the prosecutors had handled the case. They believe that they introduced some inappropriate evidence, that they destroyed some evidence that would have been helpful to him. And so he sought monetary damages, and the Supreme Court held that that's not 1983 is really not a vehicle for him to be able to bring this claim, that really a federal habeas corpus statute would be more suitable. And so this Heck v. Humphrey case was applied here, even though Mr. Olivier was seeking prospective relief, that is, relief for an injunction to enjoin this particular ordinance. So that's what happened at the district court. And then it went to the Fifth Circuit panel, and there's a decision, Clark v. Stadler, that the court cited that seemed to indicate pretty strongly that that Heck doctrine actually does apply to injunctive relief. From there, and it may have been around this time that we had our discussion, Tobias, we found a petition for en banc, which I thought had a very good chance of being accepted, but it was denied by a 9-8 count, which was, as we discussed before, was frustrating. It was tantalizing, and it was really a difficult thing to see. But by one vote, we were not able to get the full Fifth Circuit to consider, and so that's when we turned to the Supreme Court.
Well, and I assume a lot of our listeners probably know about Section 1983, but let's back up a little bit there just to make sure people know the lay of the land. So I assume when you brought your suit in the district court on behalf of Mr. Olivier, it was under Section 1983, which is the federal civil rights statute that allows people to bring civil actions against state or municipal actors who have violated or are going to violate their federal statutory or constitutional rights. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It goes back to the Civil Rights Act of 1871, but through 42 U.S.C. 1983, what it allows for citizens, if they feel like they have constitutional rights violated, they can seek relief, they can seek compensation, should they have a right to it in federal court through this federal statute.
And the key thing that you were asking for was the prospective injunction that would bar the ordinance from applying to him so that he could then go back out and share his faith without the fear of being arrested again.
That's it. That's exactly right. Just very practical relief of being able to go out there again without fear of arrest.
Got it. Well, and so obviously having rehearing on bonk denied, you know, by a single vote is extremely frustrating, but you did get what at least we Supreme Court practitioners consider a pretty big silver lining, which is that you got some fantastic opinions in the dissents from the denial of rehearing on bonk.
Yes, it's sort of like the second best thing, right? we did an excellent dissent from Judge Ho, Judge Ullman, and Judge Ouellette, I believe, as well. And so, yeah, we had three separate dissents, and then that was very helpful when we petitioned the Supreme Court to consider.
Yeah, well, so then that brings us to the cert petition. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the two issues that you asked the court to decide and that they've now agreed to hear?
Yeah, it's two distinct issues. They both concern just a basic right to having your day in court, because that's what we believe that Mr. Olivier was deprived of here. One is the applicability of the Heck bar to prospective relief. Should it apply to prospective relief? Heck itself dealt with monetary damages. It seems to be far more appropriate to apply in that scenario than to someone who's seeking relief in the future. That's the first issue. And the second issue is whether the Heck bar can apply to someone who had no access to federal habeas corpus. And so with all this discussion about that being the proper way for individuals like these prisoners who are seeking relief, that's what they need to pursue. It doesn't seem to be applicable to someone who never had access to that statute.
Got it. And so I'm going to try to put on the hat of your opponent now briefly, and I think articulate the argument that the Fifth Circuit, at least it seemed to have adopted on those points. And please tell me if I get any of this wrong. I think the theory is behind the Fifth Circuit's rule that if you could bring in a civil rights action under Section 1983 to get an injunction against the enforcement of a law that you had previously been convicted of violating, and you succeed, that sort of necessarily implies that actually your conviction wasn't valid in the first place. And that's ostensibly where the concern that animates Heck versus Humphrey comes in. Although, of course, if you were never in custody, then, you know, whether you had access to federal habeas is a separate question. Does that sort of encapsulate the retrospective versus prospective piece of it?
I think that's exactly right. And that certainly was a concern that was that the court really emphasized in Heck was this idea that of respecting comity between federal and state courts, and that this would allow really a second bite at the apple if you're allowed to go into federal court after going to state court.
Got it. And so what then, you know, what kinds of, you know, legal issues are these really? Is this ultimately a sort of statutory interpretation case?
There are some, I think it's more of a statutory understanding, not interpretation as much, Tobias, because it really, what's at play here is a court-made doctrine, and that's this Heck doctrine. And really, what is the scope of it? What's the breadth of it? While you can see how it can apply to a prisoner who has access to federal habeas and is seeking monetary damages, can it really apply to someone like Mr. Olivier, who was not a prisoner and is really focusing on relief that would not necessarily have any effect on the underlying conviction?
So I think you mentioned, you know, the Heck bar first came in Heck versus Humphrey in 1994. Obviously, the Supreme Court is a lot more textualist now in terms of how it thinks about interpreting statutes. Do you have a sense of how that shift in interpretive method might come into play here?
You know, I'm not really sure. I think that's a great question, Tobias, and I don't know if I have an answer to it. I agree with your premise that the court is more textualist now than it was in 1994, but I'm not sure that it would necessarily make a difference, because really I think what you're talking about, how does this heck doctrine apply, which really doesn't, is really not linked to the verbiage of either the two statutes that we're referencing here, the civil rights and the federal habeas corpus statute.
Got it. Well, and so I think, and speaking of the passage of time here, am I right that aside from one of the so-called shadow docket rulings earlier this year, the last time the Supreme Court squarely considered the scope of the heck bar was Skinner versus Switzer, which was 2011, I think.
that's true. It's been a while, and there have been some changes in the court since. There again, I'm not sure how much that will could change a possible outcome here. Skinner itself, interesting case, really dealing with someone bringing a 1983 claim as a prisoner, was a post conviction claim, and it was for DNA testing that they wanted to have DNA testing, and the question before the court was, and it's dealing with these two things we've talked about, should this be brought under 1983 or should this be brought under a federal habeas corpus? And the majority felt that it was very appropriate to be brought under 1983. The dissent, which was Kennedy, Alito, and Thomas, they disagreed. They thought that it ought to be brought under federal habeas. I'm not sure that really has any impact here. What I would like to think, Tobias, I don't know if this will end up being the result, but I'd like to think that this is a case where both the majority and the dissenters in that case would see things the same way, because that matter did not deal with prospective relief. Neither did it deal with this access to federal habeas.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the lineup in Skinner v. So that means the majority was the Chief Justice and then Justices Ginsburg, Scalia, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. So obviously a little bit of a sort of ideological scramble, at least compared to the stereotypical lines that people focus on. Maybe the answer is who knows. But do you have any sense of sort of how this plays with the four justices who've joined the court since then, and whether it breaks down on ideological grounds at all, or are we kind of looking at a free-for-all here?
You know, you raise a great question, Tobias. I tend to think that this case could be more in line with what they refer to the high percentage of cases where the justices actually do find agreement. We tend to hear about the ones when they don't. Those are the ones that are highly publicized. Those are the ones where we hear about the conservative said this, but the liberal said this. I'm not sure that that's going to be the situation here, although there I think there could be some of that in their reasoning. But I think because we're dealing with a fundamental issue as far as having your day in court, I think this is something where we can find broad appeal.
Absolutely. Well, and I will pause for a second. I see we've got a question in the Q&A here. So I think this goes maybe a little bit more to the underlying merits, but of course, I know this is very relevant to your day-to-day practice as well. And the question here is whether the Mississippi Religious Freedom Restoration Act might provide any help to Mr. Olivier as to the merits of his claims related to his breaching.
Well, that's a great question, and that's a question that we would love to get to at some point, Tobias. With this case, as you know, what we're looking for is really the ability to get to the merits of that type of claim, as well as his free speech claim, his free exercise of religion claim. I think all those would have considerable merit and should be considered here. And so that's what we're trying to get to, is just to the point where a federal judge will consider, hey, does this claim have merit or not?
Got it. Well, and actually, and this is one that just occurs to me off the top of my head, so I don't actually know the answer to this, but if you tried to bring the same set of claims in a Mississippi state court, would you face the same kind of obstacles?
It would. With a Mississippi state court, are you referring to like a civil court or in the criminal matter?
Yeah, well, so if you sought injunctive relief in sort of the same kind of way that you had in the district court, but in the Mississippi state court.
Yeah, that I think that would be, we would have to have some state claims. And so perhaps there could be something that could be cobbled together where if conceivably if you brought a false arrest claim or something of that nature, and then also you brought with it some constitutional claims, that would be something that could be pursued. I believe that for the most, this isn't always the case, but I do think there are good reasons for bringing federal claims in federal courts. They're the ones that they're more accustomed to dealing with these types of constitutional issues. They're more accustomed to 1983 claims. And so it's something that is much better served, I believe, in federal court if you're pursuing these types of claims.
Well, and speaking of which, so that brings us to a precedent that features at least prominently in your opening merits brief. And that certainly jumped out at me when I first heard about your case, which is Woolley versus Maynard. Can you tell us a little bit about what the court decided there and how it plays in here?
Oh, it's one of those fun cases, Tobias, you know, that you read in law school, where this was the license plate case in New Hampshire, where individuals took issue to the state motto being put on the license plate of live free and die, that actually they wanted another option there. And because of that, they did not want to be what in essence would be a mouthpiece for the state. They did not want to communicate that through their vehicle. So that was at the heart of their claim. But they had been convicted of violating this law actually several times when they brought a claim an additional time in order to challenge it in order to enjoin it. And so it is really, the scenario is almost nearly identical to what we have here, where you have someone who was convicted under what they claim to be an unconstitutional law. They want to try to challenge it, to enjoin it from being applied to them in the future. And in the same scenario in Woolley, their younger abstention was brought up. But the court really quickly discarded this whole idea that there could be any type of hurdle to these plaintiffs because they should have the right to have the court consider the merits of their claims as it would apply to their future activity.
And so that case, I think, supports the prospective retrospective distinction that you're talking about, because while the Heck bar and Younger abstention are different, the underlying question is still, you know, are you essentially interfering with state proceedings? And then Woolley, the Supreme Court said, bringing a claim purely for a prospective injunction doesn't interfere with past or even necessarily ongoing state proceedings, as long as all you're asking for is an injunction against future enforcement.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And for that reason, that's why we did cite Woolley. We think that it's really directly in line with that particular issue that's before the court.
And what answer, if any, did you get about Woolley's application from the Fifth Circuit judges who were not persuaded by your position, or did it even come up?
No, they didn't address it, so I don't really know. But they really did focus on the things that you talked about, and also and certainly in fairness to the panel, they relied heavily on the Clark case, and they felt really constrained as to what they could do, that they couldn't really go beyond what was precedent in that court.
Well, that brings up an interesting question, which I've dealt with a couple times myself. I think people tend to assume that by the time a merits case reaches the Supreme Court, the arguments have been, you know, sort of perfectly ventilated and articulated by either side in the lower courts. But here, the district court and the panel both felt that they were constrained by the circuit precedent in Clark. Then you actually didn't get rehearing en banc by that narrow one vote denial. And then the cert stage briefing, you know, as it naturally is just focused on really should the court hear the questions at all, and less so the merits. And I think your opponent's brief is still about, 3 weeks away. Do you feel like you've actually seen the best arguments on the other side of this case yet?
I think I have to, guys. Our arguments were certainly different And I trust that there's probably will be a little bit as well at the petition stage, because what we're trying to point out there is that there's a circuit split. Circuit split is really undeniable on QP2, and that is dealing with this issue of access to federal habeas corpus. I mean, it's like very deep divide of like 6-5. And then with the first, we were able to point to a Ninth Circuit decision that ruled completely different from the Fifth Circuit on this issue. And then also there was some strong dictum in the Tenth Circuit as well. So we felt like we could demonstrate the split, certainly a substantial part of their briefing at the cert petition stage was, no, there actually isn't a split. So you did have that disagreement, but they did get into the merits, and I'm not sure that there is anything left substantively. Perhaps they can argue it a little bit different. Maybe they can find a different way of taking the same tact. But what I would expect is essentially the same.
Got it. Well, and so what, at the risk of making you play devil's advocate, what do you think is the capsule summary for the city's position on the merits? Why should Heck bar prospective claims?
Yeah, I think it does get back to some of the things are brought up in Hack, and that was echoed by the Fifth Circuit about respecting state courts, and that certainly we need to we're not really being helpful as federal courts if we're constantly overturning things that the state courts are doing. And so there has to be a respect there for those parallel jurisdictions and respect for what's going on with the state criminal court, and be concerned, I believe, about actions that seem to be an end run where you didn't like what happened in state criminal court. And so I'll just file in federal court and see if I can get my way there with a different judge. And so I think that's the kind of thing that they want to avoid. And so I think that's probably their best argument. I just don't think it really fits particularly well with the way it's being set up here because of our focus on prospective relief. While if the claim was about damages, where this was about false arrest, which really goes to the heart of whether or not that conviction was correct or not, then that could be a different issue. But when the focus is more on the constitutionality of the ordinance itself and not really what happened, we're not trying to revisit what happened, I don't think as much.
Got it. Well, it looks like we've got another quick question in the chat here. This is another one that I think is a little bit maybe geared towards the First Amendment merits. But the question is whether Snyder versus Phelps gives you any support, I think, on the sort of underlying merits question of whether Mr. Olivier has a right to share his faith in this public way.
Well, I think that issue has certainly come up. And in fact, that's something that they brought up or something similar to that as far as, I'm sorry, I'm back up a little bit. It was Snyder versus Phelps really talking about protection afforded offensive speech. That just because speech is offensive doesn't mean it lacks protection. And so that's something that was dealt with there with Snyder versus Phelps, dealing with these remarks at funerals where it seemed to be distasteful. Disdained, but nevertheless constitutionally protected. And so there, I think that in the briefing from the other side, they have taken some cheap shots at Mr. Olivier, and really has mischaracterized his speech in a lot of ways. But the tenor of it seems to be that he's saying things that really should not be protected. He's saying things that are offensive, that people don't like, and it really shouldn't be protected in the first place. And so although I don't believe it goes anywhere near to like a Snyder versus Phelps level. Certainly, I would say if he's talking about sin, he's talking about people committing sin and a need for God, that plenty of people find that offensive. And so there's no question that offense is a reality there. And so in that same way, even though we have different facts, the principle would apply.
Understood. Well, so some of the arguments here, in particular on the prospective versus retrospective point, I think touch on whether Mr. Olivier's claims are more like a common law malicious prosecution suit, which the Supreme Court has said requires a favorable termination of the underlying prosecution before you can sue over it, or if his claims are more like an anti-suit injunction, which doesn't have the same kind of requirement. And when I was reading that portion of the briefing, to me, it suddenly sort of, you know, snapped my mind into the mode of analysis that we do in Second Amendment cases now, right? We're sort of looking for historical analogs. But as we talked about before, this is ultimately sort of a statutory case, at least at the top level. So how does that sort of exercise of looking for analogies fit in here and thinking about what claim is or is not allowed?
Well, that was something that the court dealt with in depth in Heck itself, where the court found malicious prosecution to be a tort analog, really with the idea of trying to determine, okay, if this constitutional claim is viable, we have to look at what the elements would be. And so to figure out what the elements would be, then we have to look at the tort analogy. And there was a malicious prosecution, which made a whole lot of sense because his claim centered on the actions of county prosecutors, what they did, what they didn't do. And so that was at the heart of that particular case. And that's why I think the malicious prosecution was certainly appropriate analogy there. And then getting to that element, oh, well, you have to have a favorable termination in state court before you can bring a malicious prosecution claim or their constitutional claim. Well, so I guess a couple of things, Tobias, is not all constitutional claims necessarily require a tort analog. And so while I think it can be helpful, I think it's certainly helpful in Heck itself. I don't know if it's particularly helpful here because particularly when you focus in on the injunctive relief, when you're talking about a claim of free speech, free exercise of religion, there really isn't a tort analog. So I don't know if that's even a road that the court needs to take here. I don't know if they really need to go down that path. But if they did, yes, anti-suit injunction would seem to be far more analogous here, and that doesn't have the same favorable termination requirement.
Yeah, so that was going to be one of my questions is, you know, I think a lot of us are familiar, you know, either in our practice or for those of us who aren't lawyers, you know, just seeing in the press, cases that involve people litigating to protect their First Amendment rights. And normally the thing that you have to establish there is just that what the government is doing is restricting your speech or would restrict your speech or your exercise of your religion, and not that you also have to check any sort of additional boxes along the way to establish the merits of your claims.
Yeah, I think that's what makes Heck different from this case and something that we tried to harp on in the merits brief, Tobias, is that there it centered on monetary damages, getting compensation for the actions of prosecutors. And when you have a damages claim, I think that's when a tort analog is far more appropriate. As here, if there was a false arrest type component to this, that if we said his constitutional rights were violated because he was falsely arrested, well then that would make more sense to have a tort analog and to analyze, okay, what was it require then to establish a false arrest tort? But here, when it is purely really a constitutional claims, it's just not as relevant.
Understood. And I know that some of the other arguments here have at least touched on the fact that another plaintiff, someone other than Mr. Olivier, who hasn't been convicted of violating the law in question, could still get an injunction against its enforcement. And at least until recently, if I were the city's lawyer, I would have said, well, that cuts against Mr. Olivier's position, because even if he can't get an injunction, somebody else can get one, and that injunction might help him anyway. But of course, as I'm sure a lot of our audience knows, the Supreme Court recently held in Trump versus Casa that so-called universal injunctions are not proper, meaning federal courts can't issue injunctions that benefit non-parties. So does that point now sort of tip in your direction because everybody needs to be able to get their own injunction?
I think so. I think that's very helpful because that has been an argument that we have seen from the other side, where they have pointed out the existence of this other person who is pursuing constitutional claims. And because what we have argued is that is really spoke to the inequity about the situation where you have a person who is charged and convicted under what we believe is an unconstitutional ordinance. And yet he is forever barred from challenging it, ever. No matter the context, he can never challenge, even though he wants to continue to go out and he's subject to arrest under that same unconstitutional ordinance. And so as way of rebuttal, what we've heard from the other side is, well, that's not necessarily the case. He may not be forever barred because other people can challenge. In fact, there is this one person who's challenging it. So if that person obtains relief, that relief could also be attributed to Mr. Olivier. There are some questions about that because their claims aren't exactly the same. They really come at it from different ways, different types of speech. But nevertheless, I think your point is well taken, Tobias, is that I think that argument is largely gutted now because of the Trump versus Casa case, in the sense that in order for Mr. Olivier to get relief for Mr. Olivier, he has to be able to bring his own claim.
Well, and even before Trump versus Casa narrowed the scope of available injunctions, there was still something of an irony in that response from your opponents because I can't remember now whether it was Judge Ho or Judge Oldham who pointed it out in the Fifth Circuit, that somebody who's been convicted of violating an apparently unconstitutional law is maybe the ideal plaintiff to actually challenge it because, of course, they clearly have standing to do so. It affects them concretely.
Right. Well, yeah, I think they both touched on it. And Judge Ho, yeah, really, really referred to it as a catch-22, because that is something that civil rights plaintiffs face a lot, as you well know, Tobias, is really the ability to establish standing. You can't just challenge a law out of the blue because you think it's unconstitutional. You have to demonstrate that this law would have been applied to you. And what better way to show that than it actually has? And I think that was Judge Ho's point there, and it's a very good one, is that in requiring these plaintiffs to establish standing, it just doesn't seem right or constitutional to be able to take that away under some other doctrine.
Well, so pivoting a little bit from the sort of legal nuts and bolts, What do you see as the potential practical implications of the Supreme Court's decision here? And in particular, you know, how much does it matter whether they decide one question or the other question or both of them?
The implications are huge, I believe, Tobias. And I think it goes far beyond folks like us who like to sit around and talk about legal issues. I think it has some very practical implications for civil rights plaintiffs, where if you're denied your day in court, you're in essence denied your constitutional freedoms. It's a critical corollary. If you don't have a right to be able to assert those freedoms, you might as well not have them. And that's been, I think, proved out here with Mr. Olivier. So that's really what's at stake with both of these issues. Where it really does come down to doesn't civil rights plaintiffs deserve their day in court to have their claims heard? Now, as far as the two different issues, yeah, I think the first is first for good reason. That's the one that we felt was the more prominent of the two, although we think both have considerable merit. But we listed the perspective relief first because that's the one that just seemed to stick out more, even though there wasn't as much of a circuit split as there was with the second one. We just felt that it was just much more egregious. And so the United States has filed an amicus brief, which we're very excited to receive. And they took the position there that the court should rule it in our favor on QP1, but not on QP2. But in framing it, the U.S. stated that really shouldn't even consider QP2 and just rule in our favor on QP1. And of course, that'd be an excellent result. And if that's the case, we'd be very happy with it.
Right. And just as in case it may not be obvious to some of our audience, that is a possible outcome here that would still be a win for Mr. Olivier because these are independent grounds for the Heck Bar not to apply to him, right? So if you're right about either the first or the second, his suit can go forward, but the city has to win both in order to stop it.
Yeah, thank you so much, Tobias, for that clarity. That's exactly right. And that's the way these two things work. So if we win on either one of them, Mr. Olivier wins here, and that he'd be able to pursue his day in court.
Well, and your mention of the United States as amicus is a nice segue into my next question. You know, you're scrolling on the docket on this case. It's just amicus brief after amicus brief after amicus brief on your side of the case. Your petition and merits brief are both supported by an impressive and pretty diverse array of amici. Can you tell us just a little bit about, one, just the process of finding folks to weigh in here to lend their support, and then also thinking about different angles for them to cover, which, of course, the more amici you have, in some ways, the more challenging that is.
Yeah. We are very excited for the amicus support at both the cert stage and the merit stage. We received, I believe, is 13 at the cert stage and 16 plus the U.S. at the merit stage, and that's just outstanding amicus support, and so we're so glad and grateful for it, and not just the quantity but also the quality. I mean, really some excellent analysis that's set forth in the amicus briefs, able to touch on some things that really, due to our page limitations, sometimes we can't do. We do actually have an excellent staff at First Liberty that try to help coordinate amicus support. And I definitely do not want to belittle their efforts, because they have worked very, very hard on it. But I believe that the most compelling thing has been the issue itself. We present it. We say, hey, we've gone to organizations and attorneys who do amicus briefs, and we've just received very positive feedback. It just seems to resonate that is almost a guttural type feeling, that visceral. It's like, yes, there's something wrong here, and we want to be part of it. And so that's the type of support we've received here.
And in that process, you know, how much of it is your team suggesting potential angles or subjects to your amici? How much of it is them saying, hey, we've got something we want to say about this? And or how much of it maybe is sort of halfway between?
A lot of that is really, we're interested in receiving whatever type of support that amici are willing to lend, and so it's not as though we've tried to look for particular angles or to particular support on an issue or as much as we've asked them what they're interested in doing. Now, if someone says, "Hey, we want to be part of this, we want to participate," But we're unsure how to help. What's the best way? We can certainly, and we have made suggestions in that regard. But for the most part, these are different organizations. These are different individuals who come at it from their own perspective. And so I think what they have done is they've been true to their perspective of how it could affect them, just as the United States has, just how it can affect them, what they're interested in. And that's what they've spoken into. And I think it's just really worked out very, very well, because it's addressed both issues. And really, I believe that between our merits brief and the amicus briefs, that we've been very thorough in dealing with the arguments.
Well, and speaking of the United States' interests here, I was mildly surprised to see one of the grounds that the government identified for weighing in here is that the court's decision in this case could potentially affect suits against federal officials and agencies. And that surprised me, just because Section 1983 is available for suits against state and municipal actors, but not against federal officials. Do you have any sense of what was sort of motivating their concern there?
I'm not sure. As you know, Tobias, part of the United States, just like any other amicus, as a introductory part, they need to demonstrate what was your interest in this case? Why are you interested in it? So they set forth this paragraph, and that's one of the reasons that they mentioned. I can only assume that they're referring to like Bivens actions, which are corresponding actions where you can bring constitutional claims against federal officials. And so because there is possible constitutional claims against federal officials, they'd be concerned about something like this, and they want to weigh in on it.
Understood. Well, and some of our audience may know that when you reach the merit stage at the Supreme Court, if it's private party versus private party or it's private party versus state, everybody wants the federal government as an amicus on their side if they can swing it.
That is so true.
And the Solicitor General's office often holds what is sort of almost like a little mini audition or moot process where each party goes in separately and essentially pitches the government on joining their side. I assume you had to do that song and dance here.
Oh, we did. And it's a very interesting process. And it's just as you described it, Tobias, where we were told that they met with the other side right before us. And they were friendly, but it was more like a panel. I mean, there are very difficult, hard questions that they posed. But we're still very heartened by it because there are a lot of attorneys there from their civil rights division, and we thought that signaled a strong interest in the civil rights and religious liberty freedoms that they were bringing in the case.
And I assume then that they followed their usual habit so that you didn't actually know if they were going to support you until you actually saw the brief come in.
That's right. That's exactly right. So you don't know until you don't know that they're going to appear at all. And if they do appear, you don't know if it's going to be for you or against you until you actually see the brief itself. And so that was our first indication. And so it was both a sigh of relief and elation when we saw it.
Absolutely. Well, and you mentioned, of course, you know, one of the reasons that this case seems to resonate with so many people, including, of course, with the government, is that the facts clearly implicate important religious liberty issues. But, you know, those questions don't technically have anything to do with the legal doctrine, with the questions presented about the scope of the HEC bar. So how do you think that the religious liberty concerns, if at all, play into the court's decision to hear the case and then the merits?
It's interesting, and it probably harkens back to something I've already mentioned in our discussion, Tobias, is really how vital it is that we have a right to assert our constitutional rights. It's something that I think we tend to take for granted, that of course we have, but if we don't have a right to assert those constitutional rights, we truly do not have them. And so I think that makes it a very critical component of the right to free speech, the right to free exercise of religion. And I believe that's part of what resonates, is that there could be some arguments from the other side, perhaps dealing with the speech, perhaps dealing with the legitimacy or lack thereof of the ordinance in place, whether or not there's a reasonable restriction. All those things can be hashed out in court, but this cuts off the discussion. There is no discussion. There is no analysis. You lose, go home. And so I think that resonates with a lot of people, including the Supreme Court.
Absolutely. On a more practical note, do you have an oral argument date yet?
We do not. What we're anticipating is first, second week in December. Could possibly be pushed off to January, but what we believe is first or second week in December. And of course, as you know, is you don't really. The best you can get from the clerk is that, well, you might want to keep December free, but you don't really get more insight than that.
Yeah. I do actually feel for the folks in the clerk's office at the court who have to line up oral arguments. It does feel like they're playing a little game of Tetris over there with everybody's schedules, and then they have to accommodate the justices who want to line up this case with that case, and it's a lot.
No question. Yeah, it is.
Another question just came in. Let me take a look at this one. This one also is a relatively complex one about sort of underlying First Amendment merits. So I think we're going to, with apologies to that questioner, we'll leave that one to the side for now. I think some of the questions here, I think, speak to one of the things that we've just been talking about, which of course is, even though this case on its surface is about the sort of technical question of the HEC bar, when can you get your day in court? What's the scope of that doctrine? really it does bring up a lot of people's quite passionate feelings about issues of free speech, about religious expression. And of course, that's one of the things that sort of captivates people about it.
It does. And we actually received several amicus briefs regarding those type of interest, interest in being able to engage in religious speech, even though the question is more of a forerunner. It's more of a technical question. That is, do you have the ability to get to the merits of that issue? I think people see that those rights are so important that we have to protect the right to assert them.
And in that vein, we have another questioner here who's asking, I think, basically, how was Mr. Olivier's evangelizing sort of equated with or treated as protesting in the first place? Is that just a label that the city slapped on him?
That's exactly right. They saw someone who he was handing out literature and he was talking to people. And that one point he had a sign. And so even though it had nothing to do with the event itself, so there's no, it's not like they were protesting what was going on in the amphitheater or any particular political issue per se. That's how they labeled it because that's how they saw it. And so once they labeled it as a protest, that's how they decided to treat it as a protest.
Got it. All right. Well, I think that is all the questions from me. And I'll encourage our audience, if any of you have any further questions, please do put them in the chat and we'll try to get to them. But in the meantime, Nate, is there anything else that you'd like everybody to know about the case? Anything that we should have talked about that we haven't touched on yet?
I think you're pretty thorough, Tobias. I can't really think of any legal issue, but I do greatly appreciate the interest. I think sometimes when maybe others who are not appellate or Supreme Court litigators start talking about something like the Heck Bar, we tend to that tends to be something that could put us to sleep and we sort of doze off. But this is an extremely important case. It's extremely important because it deals something with very fundamental for all of us, and that is the ability to have our day in court.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I think we can leave it there then. So I will turn it back over to Marco. Thank you so much, Nate. Thank you, everybody, for taking the time to hear from us today.
Thank you.
Well, I want to second that thanks to both of you for that fantastic discussion and the benefit of your time and expertise today. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I would also like to thank you, our audience, for joining us. We greatly appreciate your participation. For information on more upcoming events, please visit our website or all major social media platforms at FedSoc. On that note, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.